Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. It's a physical therapy day today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. And back to share their insights and advice are our two physical therapists, and they want to spend a little time talking about sitting on your butt. Jill Tynisbaum, professor of the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to have you back.
It's great to be here. Good morning, everyone.
And good morning to you. And Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to see you as well.
Awesome to be here on a rainy Monday. Glad for some rain.
I am as well. And as we talk with our two guest experts, I hope you'll join in. What physical therapy questions do you have? Join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Well, we're sitting.
Oh, we are. And honestly, neither of us, any of us really like to sit.
No, I like to get up and around.
Exactly.
Which is good. That's a really good habit to have, even if your job does require you to sit.
How much sitting is too much, do you think?
Wow.
There's a lot of people who want to answer that question. Mm-hmm. And the World Health Organization, for the first time in 2020, recommended reducing sedentary behaviors because of their negative health consequences, and that is sitting. And you think about how the world has changed, you know, in my lifetime, from work that required standing, moving, to work now so much of it is information-based. Uh-huh. Particularly in developed countries like ours. And we spend a lot of our time sitting.
Is it bad for us? Is sedentary behavior bad for you regardless of your age or your health or otherwise?
It tends to be across the board. It's bad for your health across the board. And one of the questions that people have been trying to answer is the question you asked at the beginning, how much is too much? And that's really hard to tease out because there are a number of factors that come into it. And one of them being, how much time do you spend in leisure activity to offset the amount of sitting you do? So you have how much sitting are you doing, and then how much activity do you do the rest of your day? And how intense is that activity? So what we know is that people who mostly sat at work, and this study was done in Taiwan, which was interesting because the demographics of this population are pretty different from people in the U.S. That is, they're generally healthier. Hmm. The percentage of people with a BMI over 30 in the study from Taiwan was 4%. The percentage of people in the U.S. with the BMI over 30 is 42.4%.
So almost half the population.
So you'd think then that the findings from the study that you're going to be telling us about would actually be worse
in the U.S.
Absolutely. In the U.S.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
So what they found is that people who mostly sat at work had a 16.16% higher all-cause mortality and a 34% increased risk of death from cardiovascular disease. And this was across the band of different activity levels, from low, medium, high leisure activity. All those activity levels did not offset people who mostly sat at work. Only when you got to the very high, the intense activity level, leisure time activity level, did it offset the mostly sitting at work. And in fact, it took approximately 4 to 5 times the World Health Organization of recommendation of exercise, which is 150 minutes per week, to offset prolonged sitting.
So that's I think that information is really telling. I think, as Lori referred to earlier, we talked about how there's so much more technology with jobs, how it's kind of pushing us into a sedentary behavior at work. And I think a lot of people think, well, you know, when I get home at the end of the day, I go for a walk or something like that. What this study is demonstrating is that unless you're doing very high vigorous activity, it's not going to be enough to offset the sedentary behavior of an 8-hour workday, which is done mostly sitting. And I think, as Lori alluded to, this is the first study that's really tried to control for all the other variables and identify the risk and how much activity is really required to offset that prolonged sitting.
Wow. I'm thinking about people.
Stand up right now, don't you, Larry?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about myself sitting on the couch watching the U.S. Open for about 3 hours yesterday.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
would have been a lot better to be out there golfing yourself, right?
Yeah, well, I guess it would have been for sure. Well, so how worried do people? I also thought about people who were, for one physical reason or another, just can't get out and do the extreme amount of...
Right. And you don't have to. So if you... What the workplace needs to do is to create a structure where people can move a little bit more at work. So whether you get up and you walk to the break room to get another cup of coffee or a drink of water. Work needs to allow people to have the opportunity to get up and move throughout the day. You know, they also talk about sit to stand, like standing desks, and people mm-hmm. who worked at both sitting and standing did better in terms of their cardiovascular risk. It was fairly linear if you look at the data from mostly sitting to sitting standing to, you know, mostly standing kinds of activities. So if you can do some sitting and standing, that's better. If you can get up and stand and take a brief walk, that's better too. But the workplace demands that require people to sit for hours on end without a break, it's not sustainable in terms of population health and the costs to the society, to the individual and the family of the risk of this disease.
And it's interesting, this study looked at cardiovascular risks and morbidity and mortality, but one of the things that we always talk about as well is the musculoskeletal consequences of just sitting for a prolonged period of time. So this doesn't even scratch the surface on creation of back pain, things like that. And so I think there's more to it, the prolonged sitting, than just this study implicates.
So I've often heard the phrase, sitting is the new,
new smoking.
Yep. But the health risks of prolonged sitting and smoking, are they really comparable?
No. But in terms of the cost to the individual, the family, the workplace, and society are similar.
Okay.
And as Jill alluded to, it's not just the cardiovascular, the 34% increase in cardiovascular disease and the 16% increase in all-cause mortality for people who mostly sit. And this is, again, in a relatively healthy population.
Right.
We also have the medical and health costs of the musculoskeletal issues that we see, the back pain, the neck pain, the hip and knee pain from being sedentary.
Well, I'm thinking about our population here in Wisconsin with our BMI around 43 or 44%, as opposed to the other.
Right.
I'm thinking that walking or doing anything is going to be better and is going to have some usefulness, unlike it didn't seem to be the case in the other study.
Absolutely. And again, this was a different population, but they did look at different levels of physical activity.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, it was self-reported physical activity. So if I were to generalize, I would say that most people would self-report that they're more active than they actually are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. So I would think that the data is actually stronger than it might seem here in terms of the self-reported leisure time physical activity.
So what should the average Wisconsin person be doing in terms of who is sitting, has to sit?
I think this goes beyond just what the average person should do and what society should do and what large organizations should do. So if you work for a very large company and a lot of your workforce is required to sit, why not implement an exercise class at lunchtime or allow them time to go exercise in the middle of the day at your facility, a variety of ways, you know, don't charge them time off, whatever, something like that, to encourage them to exercise. And what you'll see, I think, is that their healthcare costs, if you're also paying for their healthcare, would go down. So I think it's a way to incentivize perhaps bigger organizations and companies to look at what they're doing to encourage physical activity, because ultimately it will help them with their health care costs.
And maintain employees. They'll have happier
Absolutely.
Employees and probably more productive employees
Absolutely.
Because they're healthier. They're potentially more alert after Sure. getting up and moving, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I'm still thinking of those who aren't working, but who are mm-hmm. sitting mm-hmm. as much as somebody who is working all day.
So you're talking about the person who's not working, but basically sitting all day.
Maybe
retired. Yeah. Well, again, we need to figure out a way to reach those people to get them to be a bit more active. And sometimes they have, you know, musculoskeletal issues. So that's where they come to physical therapy. We help them, you know, I say essentially dig them out of that hole that they're in, get them to be more active, and get exercise and activity to be part of a sustainable lifestyle. So, you know, one of my primary goals with patients that I see, particularly if they are not regular exercisers, is to help them find something that they enjoy, that they can do, that is sustainable after they discontinue physical therapy. So if I can make somebody who was previously not exercised a lifetime exerciser, that's probably the best thing I can do for their health in general.
And along those lines, so that's such a good point, Lori, and I agree with you completely. Finding, know thyself, as Lori always says, what makes you happy? Is it exercising in a group? Is it exercising alone? Is it being outside? Are you more compliant if you're inside? The other thing I think we have to think about is there's a whole generation of women who grew up before Title IX. Exercise, physical activity was not socially acceptable. And so there's a whole cohort of women out there in their upper 60s to low 70s who grew up not knowing that exercise was a positive, good thing, welcomed, et cetera. So finding that cohort in particular, a gym or an activity or a group where they feel welcomed and they know it's okay to exercise and how to exercise is really important.
Lori Tyne-Brody, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, our guest today as we talk physical therapy. We've zeroed in a bit on sitting and what you may or what you may do to kind of help the cause along if you are in a position where you have to sit all day, or even if you're not in that position, but do it anyway. There's things that need to be done, and we'll talk some more about that, but we have some callers online with questions, and we'll be taking those questions next. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at 12:30 today, we'll talk about how people perceive and give meaning to color. Karen Schloss, an associate professor of cognition in UW-Madison's Department of Psychology and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, will be our guest then. Right now, Lori and Jill with us to talk physical therapy issues. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And let's turn to Rick in Monona. Rick, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thanks a lot for the program. It's kind of connected to sitting. For the last several months, I've had an issue with my left hip. And I noticed what happens is when I just came back from a car trip yesterday where I was sitting for 8 hours or so. And when I get out of the car to get gas or something, my left hip really hurts. But it's only for 30 seconds while I stretch it out, 30 or 40 seconds. And then when I walk, it's painless. But when I, and the same thing happens when I, if I sit on the couch for a long time, I get up and my left hip really, it just takes like 30 seconds or so for me to stand up, move a little bit, and then the pain goes away. Now, I'm 78, I'm retired, and I'm somebody that exercises regularly. When I bike, for example, it doesn't hurt at all. So it's really got me puzzled. I'm wondering if this is the beginning of a hip replacement, or do I have some of the issue going on?
Well, it sounds to me, anytime you have hip pain, the first thing we always think about is this coming from your back? And this still sounds very hip-ish to me. This sounds very joint-specific. So, you know, Rick, it sounds like you're very active. Biking is a great activity for lower extremity joints because it moves your synovial fluid around within the joint, which is a really good thing. It kind of gives that articular cartilage a bath, as we talk about. Sitting in a for a prolonged period of time, sitting on the couch and then getting up and having that 30 seconds of stiffness sounds to me like it might be just a little bit of maybe early onset osteoarthritis. I think personally, with the activity level you have, you are very far away from a total hip. I think what you're closer to is maybe seeing a physical therapist to get some recommended suggestions for activities or strengthening exercises, things along those lines.
Yep, I agree. This doesn't sound anything like you need a hip replacement. It could be a little bit of your piriformis muscle that you're sitting on. If you keep your wallet in that pocket, that would be an issue that would be easily resolvable. But I think seeing a physical therapist for one or two visits and have them take a look at it and see if there's some underlying issue that's easily resolved with a stretching program or a specific hip strengthening program is going to keep you on your way. And the next thing is, don't sit for so long, you know,
right.
And it used to be like we would get up every commercial and, you know, go to the bathroom or go get a glass of water or something. So now with streaming, sometimes you have to stop it and make yourself get up and go do something. So moving more often is going to be helpful for that hip as well.
I always tell people the analogy of a stiff hip is like having a cold car in the state of Wisconsin in December, and you go to start the car and it's a little slow to get going, but once you're warmed up, it runs just fine. Same thing happens with your joints. So kind of think about it that way, Rick, and so moving it more often will be better.
Rick, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Colleen emailed to ask if there's any advice for truckers who sit for many hours at a time.
I think trucking and airline pilots are a cohort of people that come to mind where it becomes very, very challenging because there is very few opportunities to move around a lot.
Same with bus drivers. You know,
if you're
an Uber driver or you're a delivery driver, you have the opportunity to get out and move. And I know with truckers, you're on a time schedule. And the faster you go, the sooner you get from point A to point B, you're required to make those deadlines. So it's really tough. I would try to move as much as I can in my truck. I don't know if you have the ability to shift around and change your position. The other thing you can do is you can do some isometric muscle strengthening by simply tightening muscles. And you can probably find videos for this where you practice tightening muscles from in your toes and then the top of your ankle, the bottom of your ankle, inside, outside, and you work your way all the way up to your neck and shoulders. So you can work in some muscle activation while you're sitting as a possibility.
That is a very difficult population.
Yeah, it is. Irene in Janesville will give you a chance now. Hi, Irene.
Hello. I'm 84 years old, and in February, I broke my hip on my back, the T11 vertebrae. I have been in wheelchairs off and on since then, with some walking toward the end. And I'm hoping to get out of the wheelchair fairly soon. I've had physical therapists come to my house. Mm-hmm. I've done the side-by-side walking against a counter, butt kicks, and all kinds of different things. But I'm concerned when I get back into my walker how I'm going to be doing for a whole day. And do you have some exercises I could do that would be back into my walker and then get me into a cane?
Mm-hmm. So those things are all going to happen gradually. So it's not like, okay, today you're done with your wheelchair, now you're going to a walker. You're going to gradually wean into that, where you'll use your walker, for example, around your home for short periods of time. Or if you're going out for an appointment, you might use a walker on the way in and a wheelchair on the way out if you're fatigued, depending upon the distance you have to travel. And the same thing with the transition from the walker to the cane. So your mm-hmm. physical therapist, and you're not done with PT once they stop at home, you will right. then go to outpatient physical therapy, and they will continue to work with you and make sure that you're safe and ready to start on the walker. A pool would be a wonderful place for you to exercise as well, because it's going to offload some of your body weight, and it's going to give you resistance to all the muscles underwater as you're walking and moving. So, you know, asking for a referral to exercise in the pool with a physical therapist supervision would also be a great way to keep you moving forward and getting you back out of the wheelchair, onto the walker, and onto a cane.
Good luck, Irene. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Mary in Eau Claire next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you. Boy, that was quick. I have a couple things I'm thinking about. One is about exercising on a chair with some other elderly people, as I am elderly. But I went into my primary care physician the other day, and I told her that something weird happened. I tried to do some, and I've done a lot of exercise all my life, and I tried to do a little bit of yoga. I've been quiet because it's been taking a long time getting back in shape, you know. And so I thought I would do some yoga. And you know how you put your knees down to the floor, and you know, when you're sitting down, mm-hmm. and or you get in that position. Well, I tried to do that with my right knee, and I couldn't do it with either knee, to tell you the truth. But the right knee, I couldn't do it at all.
Oh,
I couldn't
okay.
even move it down.
Yep, yep.
And so I told my primary care physician that, and she gave me an X-ray. And she came and told me that she was really sorry, but there were ways to fix it, and that I didn't have a hip anymore, and that you know, I needed a hip replacement on that side, on my right side. And this didn't alarm me as much, I suppose, it would mostly, because I have two brothers who also have osteoarthritis, and I do. And
all right. Well, that it's not unusual, Mary, if you have not sat down on the floor and sat in that sort of crisscross applesauce position for a long time. your joints and your muscles will accommodate to your usual activity level. So if you have not put your hips and knees in that position for a long time, you will lose mobility in that range. It doesn't mean that you can't reacquire that. And the arthritis didn't happen overnight. I would request a referral to physical therapy and have them give you some things to do to start to regain some of your mobility and see how you do. I didn't hear from you that you were having a lot of pain,
right,
or a lot of limitations in your activity. So from where we sit, you don't go in and have a joint replacement if you're not in pain and having a limitation in your functional activities. So I think a referral to physical therapy would be a better first step to help you regain some motion in your hips and knees, regain some strength, and see where you're at.
And you also had a question about seated exercises or chair exercises, a chair exercise program. These are wonderful. I know a lot of gyms do these, and it's a great way to strengthen your lower extremities as well as your upper extremities. The downside is there's no opportunity to kind of work on your balance. And we know that as we age, one of our greatest risks of injury is due to falls. And so if a chair exercise class could be complemented potentially with like a pool exercise program or something like that, that gets you upright and helps you work on your balance, that's a great strategy if you're able to do that. If you're not able to do that and chair exercises is really the safest thing for you, then indeed that is wonderful. Great.
Isn't there something called chair dancing?
Probably.
I'm sure there is. There's chair yoga and chair. Yep. I have no doubt that someone has invented that. That'd be a great idea.
Mary, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Barbara in Beloit, we'll go to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, good morning. I've had a problem recently that especially my left knee will start to lock when I'm going downstairs. It's not always predictable. It just kind of happens. I do have bone spurs and that kind of thing, but I'm wondering what this might signal.
So do you feel that locking is right under your kneecap, Barbara, or do you feel like it's deep within your joint? Can you tell?
You know what? I'm not completely sure. I think it's not, quote, deep necessarily.
Okay.
It's just, you know.
Right.
Uh-huh. Right. So it could be patellofemoral pain. It could be just, you know, you talked about some bone spurs. You could have a little bit of wearing away of the undersurface of your kneecap. And as we go downstairs, if that kneecap isn't tracking properly, the kneecap can kind of butt up to either side of your femur or your thigh bone. And so muscle weakness can be a contributing factor. Hip weakness may be a contributing factor. Flexibility could be a contributing factor. And I think all those things could be addressed by a physical therapist. And you're in Beloit, so you should be able to maybe access a physical therapist there. And you had mentioned both knees, so it's probably good to get both of them looked at.
Yeah, and Jill's absolutely right. That was the first thing that came to my mind. And sometimes just a few exercises and looking at your mechanics of descending the stairs. And we can correlate this with athletes and how they land from a jump. And that we see a lot of hip weakness that results in poor alignment of the knee when they land, which is really the same kind of mechanism as descending the stairs. So a few simple exercises to work on hip strengthening, as well as awareness of the relationship between your foot, knee, and hip when you go down the stairs can really help with this problem.
Yeah. Good luck, Barbara. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Cheryl in Merrimack will give you a chance now. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I've had osteoarthritis for a long time. Of course, it's getting worse as I get older.
And at the end of May, I had a pain flare up in my left knee, got an x-ray, and they said it was bone on bone. So now I have an appointment to see an ortho specialist on June 25th. So in the meantime, I'm kind of checking out what my options might be. And one that has come up is this injection of something called Synvisc,
yep,
which is, I guess it recreates some of the padding between the knee. Do you have any experience? Do you recommend it?
We have some experience with it, as does Larry.
As does Larry. Go, Larry.
Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit about it first, and then Larry can share his experiences with you, too. So, you know, arthritic changes, bone on bone, we hate to hear those kind of things. But as Lori would say, you know, you need to consider your how many days are good days and how many days are bad days in the big picture when you make a decision. If you have not seen a physical therapist, that would absolutely be your lowest hanging fruit and the first line of defense. So seeing a physical therapist to see what exercises would be appropriate for you, knowing what your knee is like, would be very helpful. The next line of defense I would consider would be the hyaluronic acid injections. The brand name that you mentioned is called Synvisc. Orthovisc is another one. And as you mentioned, it does help kind of with your articular cartilage or the padding between your knees. Research has supported it for the use of knee pain, not as much in the hip. When it originally came out, it was a series of 3 to 5 injections, and now things have changed quite a bit. Can be from 1 to 3 injections before people start seeing relief. And perhaps, Larry, maybe you want, Lori's going to say something, and then
I'll
Larry
say something.
Can tell
I'll hand it off to Larry. So you said you had a pain flare in May. I didn't hear a history of knee problems before that. So typically, we want to start with the least invasive intervention first when you first enter the medical system with a problem. So, you know, if you would say, oh, it's been 2 or 3 years and we've tried this and that and we're sort of midstream in the care of your knee, that's one thing. But you're just, it sounds like you're just entering the medical system. So we really like to start with the least invasive. And as Jill said, that's usually physical therapy first. And then it's and potentially an injection. So Larry's had this.
Yeah, I did some physical therapy first on my knee.
Oh, well, there you go.
And then there was, the discussion was to have some surgery. And but first, the doctor said, let's try Synvisc. So I did 3 shots over a period of time. I've forgotten now how many weeks went by. But about 2 weeks before my surgery, I called and said, my knee is fine. I don't need the surgery. And I, you know, that's what? At least 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, it's been a long time.
Been a long time, and I haven't needed any more help for the knee. So it
can
work.
And you've been able to maintain your activity level. So you will continue to be very active, Larry. So you're a jogger, a golfer, do some strength training, things like that. So the injection probably got you just a little bit over that hump of that flare-up that you could continue with your activity.
Yeah, I certainly recommend it. Would recommend it. Although, as like anything else, it's not everybody is going to have the same impact that I had, for sure.
Right.
Cheryl, there you go. Thank you so much for calling.
Let us know how you do.
Yeah, please do. Nick in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Nick, what's on your mind?
Hey, I've got a question for you. I'm 52 years old, and when I was like 12 years old, me and my brother were playing football. A couple days before Christmas, I kicked the wall, and for some reason, the wall didn't move. 9 of my bones did, and they all broke. And they did an x-ray, God, it's got to be like 5 years ago, and they said I got an ankle of a 70-year-old.
Okay.
And my question for you is, I like to take my black lab for a walk every day, but then by the time Friday comes along, my ankle is about 3 times the size that it should be. And I try and ice it and heat it, and it doesn't change anything. And I was wondering what I could do to hopefully keep my walks and stuff.
Well, that's tough because it sounds like you have some pretty significant osteoarthritis in that ankle. So did you fractured bones in your foot and ankle or farther up at age 12?
They just said in my ankle.
Okay.
And they also said that I got bones floating around yet.
Loose bodies, yeah.
Some loose bodies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the things that we tell people are maintain your body weight, wear good shoes that have good support. You might try a pull-on ankle sleeve to give some additional stability and some compression, which may help with the swelling, as well as icing and elevating at the after each walk. And Jill wants to say something. I can tell by looking at her.
Yeah, the challenge with the ankle is it's a very tight, congruent joint. So there's not a lot of place for swelling to go. If you have a little bit of loose bodies or spurs floating around there, it can cause some pinching. So that's probably why you see all the swelling in your ankle, because there's really nowhere for it to go. The other thing I would consider, first of all, I think seeing a physical therapist for a couple of visits, I think he'd probably benefit from some distraction and maybe a little bit of mobilization at that joint, things that Nick could do at home. The other thing they may recommend is a rocker bottom shoe, so you don't have to use your ankle as much, because now we're going to kind of send that load up to your knee, and we don't want you to have knee and hip pain. So I would see a physical therapist that specializes in, like, an orthopedic specialist that potentially specializes in ankle and foot pathology. And as Lori said, you want to wear good shoes, but they may recommend a shoe where you don't have to move your ankle as much for prolonged walking, to only use, for example, when you walk your dog.
Yeah. Nick, there you go. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Great to have them back. And we have many callers online, so let's go to the phones. And Fran in Rockford, Illinois. It's your turn. Hi, Fran.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Yeah, see, I was just going to make a comment that there is such thing as a dance fitness class from a chair. It's called Zumba Gold. Zumba has a lot of formats, and the Zumba Gold is specifically for active older adults that need kind of a modified low-impact exercise. And anyone that's properly licensed for that particular format can teach it from standing or in a chair. And then we also, as Zumba instructors, some of us can teach Aqua Zumba as well. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Oh, love it. I love it.
Thank you, Fran.
Thank you. I love it. So it is chair dancing. It's Zumba. It's a variation of Zumba. Great.
Yeah. Appreciate it very much, Fran. Thank you for calling. Lisa in Middleton, we'll give you a chance to join in now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm going on this kind of a long car ride, like 6 hours long, and then at the end of it, I'm going to be on this bike ride that goes all the way across Iowa, and I'm going to be sitting on my bike for a really long time, like hours during the day. And I'm just, you know, that you were talking about sitting and how it can affect you. Well, is sitting while biking, I mean, does it cancel each other out?
100%, Lisa. Sitting on a bike because you're physically active cancels out that sitting. And I believe the bike ride you're referring to is Ragbri. And I can guarantee you, Lisa, you won't be sitting on your bike for more than 12 or 15 miles, and you will get off and have pie.
That's right. That's right. She's riding
but it's
with
a great
Jill
question.
And I.
Yeah, she's riding with it. She's right. She's on our team. But it's a great question.
Yeah,
of is sitting, for example, and biking, or sitting and kayaking, or sitting and rowing, do those things offset? And indeed, if you're sitting to do a physical cardiovascular activity, I think the cardiovascular activity would negate the sitting.
Those activities are considered leisure time physical activity. So they fall into the activity category, not the sitting category. So they're talking specifically about sedentary sitting or sitting at work, which is generally physically sedentary.
Right.
Yeah. But it's a great point.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people with balance impairments and things like that, that there are a lot of options for cardiovascular activity. activity that you can sit and do. And the Zumba Gold is a perfect example. Rowing on a rowing machine is a perfect example. Lori has one of those. Mm-hmm. Kayaking, all of those things would be considered physical activity, even though you are sitting.
Yeah.
There you go, Lisa. Thanks for calling. Let's turn to Dot in Manitowoc. Hi, Dot.
Hi, good morning. I would like to make a comment. I have the bathroom of my house upstairs and bedrooms upstairs. But what I do when I go downstairs, I hang on to my railings. I have railings on each side of the wall, and I hope that makes a difference in some of the exercises.
Oh, absolutely. For people who are forced to use stairs during their day, that is a great way to build in activity. So, for example, I have moved my office now downstairs. So I go up and down the stairs all the time. I'll go down to my office and then I'll say, oh, geez, I forgot my water bottle. Back up the stairs, back down the stairs. So creating a space in your house where it forces you to move more often makes perfect sense. So, and I think for you, Dot, having those railings on both sides increases your safety.
Right.
Absolutely. Dot, thanks for calling. Mary in Cleveland, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question about pinched nerves in the back. Mm-hmm. I have one. My sister has one, or she had surgery. I had PT and a cortisone shot. Our dad didn't, but he had sisters who had back issues. And mm-hmm. we wondered if back issues like that are congenital.
So approximately 65% of your connective tissue is inherited. So probably. So you really do inherit some of the characteristics of your family members. You look at height, you look at hair color, eye color, those things. There's no reason to think some of the connective tissue wouldn't be inherited.
But having said that, you can still, as Lori said, a big factor of it is hereditary, but you can still offset those things with exercise, mobility exercises, things like that. But yeah, a little bit of it is how you picked your parents, as Lori likes to say.
Right. For example, I said to my mom one day, do you have a hammer toe on the second toe on your right foot? And she said, why, yes, I do. I was like, thanks a lot.
Oh, Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And now we have some open lines that we can get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Give us a call with your question relating to physical therapy. 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Sherry in Oshkosh emailed us to say that in the early 2000s, Sherry started to develop serious neck problems. Sherry had to have a C4 to C6 discectomy and fusion at age 53, probably the result of many years of working at a computer and wearing glasses.
Mm. So it sounds to me like she had a multi-level discectomy, maybe with or without a fusion where they actually fuse those levels. And if that is indeed the case, what happens above and below those levels is over time, you kind of use those joints right above and below excessively to make up for the lack of motion where they fused you, and you can actually start getting some wear and tear there. So this is a really good example of making sure that your computer station, your work environment is set up really appropriately. If you need specific glasses for a computer, for example, I need glasses for like the bifocals to read. And so I actually have a pair of computer glasses that are my entire prescription for that. Otherwise, you're constantly looking through your bifocals and you're straining your neck and tilting your neck into extension. So those kind of factors would be important to consider for somebody who does have to sit all day at work and look at a computer.
Yeah, I was curious that she said that she thought her neck problems were due to sitting and her glasses. So I wondered how the glasses came into play, but you're absolutely right. And as you have noted in the past, for people who use a laptop, the keyboard and the screen don't allow you to be in a good position. If you're in a decent position for your upper body, your shoulders, and your hands and the keyboard, you're not in an optimal position for your neck and your vision with the screen. So those are factors that have to be considered and try to come up with some solution that works for wrist, hand, shoulder, neck, and eyes.
And I have three screens in front of me right now as we speak.
There you go.
And I also have my phone out, too, with so.
But, Larry, your neck looks really good. You're in a good, your computer screens are in a good position. Your neck is in a relatively good position. So you have a good ergonomic setup. And I think what's hard is when the pandemic hit, a lot of people started working from home. They had a good setup similar to what you have at work, but then went home and started working on laptops.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I keep my microphone high.
Yeah.
So that my head has to go up to the microphone.
That's right. Like Jill's classic for setting your mirror in your car. She loves this one, and that is you get in the car and you assume the very best posture that you can, and you adjust your mirror to that. So if you start to slouch, you go to look in your mirror and you can't see it, you know you're slouching.
I went on a 1,403-mile trip by car a few weeks back to Canada to a golf course where we played a golf tournament.
That's dedication.
And then played six rounds of golf in 6 days.
Wow.
And a round is 18 holes, right, Larry?
18 holes. The course was about, according to Matt, my run, it was about 7 miles.
Wow.
Long, so a fairly long course for me.
Yeah.
So 1,400 miles, how many hours was that, Larry, and how often did you stop? Did you have kind of some scheduled stops so you could get out and stretch?
We just stopped for gas, but we had scheduled 2 nights of sleep along the way.
Right. Okay.
Great.
All right. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Having the ability to do that is important. If you're a truck driver, you don't get to do that. So
yeah, it was a long trip though.
Yeah. Well, then to get out of the car and play that much golf.
I flew back.
There you go.
Oh man, Nancy and Amory, have you got a quick question for us?
Yeah, I just had carpal tunnel surgery on my right hand, and I was told by my physical therapist that both hands, my thumbs have gotten weak, so I don't have the muscle pad like on your palm, you know, where I should. And I'm just wondering, are there exercises to strengthen thumbs? I don't imagine that's a common question.
Absolutely. And that is something that your physical therapist or your certified hand therapist, whoever you're seeing for your post-carpal tunnel surgery, should provide you. So you're exactly right, Nancy. The median nerve, which gets entrapped in your carpal tunnel, innervates the thumb side of your hand. So your thumb, your index finger, and part of your middle finger. And so one of the classic signs we see when somebody has carpal tunnel syndrome is atrophy or wasting of those big thumb muscles. So to give you some very specific precision or prehension training for those muscles would be very important. And it'll take time.
Yeah. And I'm sure your hand therapist, you know, mentioned to you, you know, the weakness in the thumb and so on, just mentioned that in passing, but is completely on top of that in terms of restoring the strength there. That's probably one of their number one goals in your plan of care.
There you go, Nancy. Thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, our guests today. And we are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today. Physical therapy is on our minds today here on WPR News for the next half hour or so. Larry Mueller here. Our physical therapist, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, and Lori Tyne-Brody as our guests today. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. The number's 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. And let's take a few emails. Can email to ask you to talk about the multi-skeletal effects of menopause, joints, frozen shoulder, and bone health. Do you need a specific physical therapist if you're diagnosed with osteopenia?
Well, those are great questions.
Yes. So I'll start with the sort of muscular and joint issues, and I'll let you jump on the bone because you love that stuff. I do too, but still. So anyway, as we reach menopause, we have a change, obviously, in our hormonal status. And we also, at the same time, are experiencing the aging effects on our joints and our muscles. Women more susceptible to frozen shoulder, more susceptible after menopause. They're not exactly sure why, but somehow related to hormonal status. We definitely begin to lose strength and mobility because of that change in the hormone status after menopause, which makes it really important to engage in ongoing, regular physical exercise. The most important is the loss of strength that we see that declines precipitously after menopause, and that can have profound effects on our ability to get down and up on the floor, our ability to sustain and hold our upright posture in a good position to offload our joints and to offload our bones. So really important. It affects really every connective tissue in your body, and most of your body is made up of liquids and connective tissue.
Right. And another thing along the musculoskeletal line is gluteal tendinopathy. We see a lot of gluteal tendinopathy in postmenopausal women, which impacts hip and loading and weight bearing and walking and all of those things. And then Ken's other question had to do with osteopenia, which is so bone loss is on a spectrum, and osteopenia is the first phase of bone loss, if you will, before you get into osteoporosis. And there are specific standard deviations away from normal that make the definition of osteopenia and osteoporosis. And as we know, when we lose those hormones postmenopausally, we do see an acceleration in bone loss, or we can see. Hormone replacement therapy is one option. And I also definitely think, I think one of Ken's questions was seeing a physical therapist to help with this. And that is a really important strategy to make sure that bone health is maintained. Strengthening bone really occurs across a spectrum of intensity, and you can load too little and the bone will not respond. You can load too much and end up with musculoskeletal pain, things like that. Your bone constantly needs to be stimulated in different ways. So in other words, if you've ever seen my sister at the high school track in her town where she lives, yeah, you will see her not just walking forward or running forward, but you'll see her doing grapevine and karaoke and walking backwards and skipping and hopping and things like that, because your bone wants to be stimulated new all the time. It wants to be stimulated differently, all of those things. So to answer Ken's very good, poignant question is, seeing a physical therapist who specializes in orthopedics, or if the individual has some sort of pelvic floor dysfunction with their hormonal changes like stress, urinary incontinence, things like that, you could also see a women's health specialist. So I think thinking about the conditions you want to address most will help you, but most orthopedic certified or orthopedic clinical specialists would be able to address all those questions that Ken had.
Roseanne emailed to say she could hardly walk after a long car trip. Solve the problem by putting the seat of a wooden kitchen seat minus the leg and back, the legs and back, on her car seat. It fixed the problem, and Roseanne feels the bucket seats somehow roll your hips. They have the same issue with their easy chair.
Absolutely. Some of the bucket seats tend to roll you in to internally rotate your hips and don't allow you to be in an optimal position. I'm still not clear on the kitchen seat thing minus the back legs.
So she just took the flat part and put it there so she wasn't in a bucket anymore and she was flat.
Oh, I get that, but I thought she... But what happened to the front legs?
Well, she took all the legs off.
Oh, took all the legs off. For some reason, I only heard the back legs. I'm like, how does that work with still the front legs?
Man, no, she made her unbucket seat. Now, Laura, you're not having a good day. She
I'm
made
not
her
having a good day.
Seat.
Clearly
she made
need
her bucket
more coffee.
Seat a non-unbucket seat.
Yep. You could do that a number of ways. You could take a towel and fill in the space. You don't have to disassemble your kitchen furniture necessarily. But I love where she went with that, Roseanne. Well done.
Yeah.
What's the difference, John wants to know, between moderate and vigorous intensity?
Oh, okay.
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Yeah, exactly. There are standards for that. And I'm kind of going to look to see if they define that. Oh, they used a standardized tool. Yeah. So metabolic equivalence. Do you remember what the, metabolic. So inactive, less than 3.75 met hours per week. So to go between high is between 16 and 25. So say around 20 hours per week or 60 to 89 minutes per day. And very high was greater than 90 minutes per day.
So 45 was the moderate or low?
So let me go back to this. Less than 15 minutes a day was inactive. Low was 15 to 29 minutes per day. Medium was 30 to 59 minutes per day. So just stop for a minute and think about that. Medium activity is basically 30 to an hour a day. High is 60 to 89 or 60 to 90 minutes per day. And very high is greater than 90 minutes per day. That's a lot of time being active. And that's leisure time physical activity. That's not standing at your kitchen sink.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if you're in a family situation.
Oh,
it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So if you have small children, things like that, it's a jogging stroller, potentially getting a 30-minute jog in. Mm-hmm. It's a bike
with a trailer
on the back, things like that. So, no, it's a point well taken, Larry. It's a very hard thing to fit into a lifestyle if you're a full-time working parent. Completely understand. I think considering a gym membership that has childcare may be a helpful option as well.
Yeah. So I know it's harder in Wisconsin because of the weather, but when I'm on the bike trail, I see people who are biking with their kids on the back of the bike early in the morning as if they are biking their children to childcare.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's a wonderful way to emphasize the importance of physical activity to your children.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I see it on campus a lot, too. There's a couple childcare centers on campus, and there's a couple women I see on bikes with. One lady has her bike, and then she has a tag-along, and then she has a trailer. So, you know, she's, you know, very long, and by God, she's doing it every day, and it's amazing. So, yeah, so I think it sends your kids a really good message as well.
Yeah, but it's not easy.
No,
we will,
it's not.
We will let John know it is not easy.
Absolutely.
But anything worthwhile, right?
Yeah.
You know, like they say.
Amy in South Phillips has a question relating to activity, I believe. Let's go there. Amy, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm in a car, so and I'm negotiating around a semi right now. So I do a lot of gardening and yard work, and I'm 58, and I get a lot of lower back pain or just stiffness afterward. So I try to vary my position, sitting and kneeling, and sometimes a gardening chair. But I've noticed that it really makes my back feel better if when I'm leaning over, I put one elbow on one knee. Mm-hmm. It just takes a lot of strain off of my lower back, and but yet you're not perfectly straight when you're doing that. So I'm hoping is that a good thing to do? If it feels good and varying the position, I would think is a good thing.
All brilliant strategies. And so, yeah. So for example, if you're standing and you're leaning over and placing your hands on the counter, you are offloading your spine to some extent. The same thing is true if you are kneeling and you put an elbow on a knee, if you're sitting and you lean forward and put your elbows on your knees. Those are all ways to unload your back. So absolutely, varying your position is going to be super important, as well as varying your task. So how you use your muscles in a task. So, you know, you may do a little bit of digging and then you may stand up and do something that's walking and then maybe come back and finish whatever you were doing with your digging. So instead of, you know, how we are start and finish a task, you may start a task, do part of it, and then switch to a different activity that requires a different position and then go back to finish the first activity, or sit down and have a cup of coffee and take a small 5-7 minute break and then go back to it. All those things are going to be strategies to prolong the life of your back.
Mm-hmm. Ellie in Madison emailed, here's something I don't know that we've covered before. Is there such a thing as facial muscle PT? Ellie's in her late 20s, deals mm-hmm. with chronic facial pain due to clenching. Are there exercises Ellie can do to alleviate this? The only thing that's worked for Ellie is Botox to the masseters, but yeah. That is off-label and very expensive.
Yes. So, Ellie, there is help for you. The masseter muscle is the muscle when you clench your teeth that pops out on the side of your jaw. So it sounds to me like Ellie's condition is probably coming from her TMJ, or it's a temporal mandibular disorder. And there are physical therapists who specialize in this. There's two or three cranial facial certified therapists in the state of Wisconsin. There's a couple in Madison. So she should just call wherever her insurance is and ask to see the therapist that specializes in TMJ or TMD. And there are people within, for example,
Madison. Madison.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's two or three really good people in Madison. So she just needs to make some phone calls and check. And if she has any questions, she can certainly leave her name and we can give her some contact information.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is one of the most painful, debilitating musculoskeletal conditions, and most people don't know that physical therapists can treat it. So absolutely.
Well, apparently not, because she must be in the medical system if she's getting Botox injections, and I'm surprised nobody has referred her to physical therapy at this point.
Well, she could be getting Botox off-label, like in a
she said it's off-label and very expensive.
Yeah. right.
So, yeah, okay. But give PT a try.
Jordan emailed to say, wondering who they can see for finding well-fitting walking running shoes. Jordan has developed pain in one heel that eventually shoots up the hip the longer they are on their feet. Can you recommend stretches or exercises to relieve the pain?
Well, it really depends upon the source of his pain. So typically, pain goes from proximal to distal, so from the hip or back down the leg. So for it to go from his heel and then up to his hip suggests to me that Jordan is changing how they move, which is creating a secondary problem at the hip. So I would start with a physical therapist to find the source of the problem in the foot. So, for example, if Jordan is doing the same things with each foot, which most people do, unless you're in a job where you stand on one leg for long periods of time, I can't think of one, but someone will call in with that suggestion. But anyway, you would expect Jordan to have the similar symptoms on both sides. So the question is, why is Jordan having problems in one heel shooting up to one hip and not the other? So thus, an examination by a physical therapist to determine the origin of the pain in the foot will help. And you can't just say this shoe or that shoe, because the cause of the pain in the foot is different for everybody. So one person may need a shoe with a straight last. Someone else may need a shoe with an arch support. Someone may need a shoe with a heel lift. So one or two visits should be able to sort through things for Jordan.
Becky and Ryo will give you a chance. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I have a lot of lower back pain from the arthritis in my lower back, and I'm wondering about cold laser therapy. If that's a physical therapy you've heard of, or is it only done through chiropractors? What do you know about it?
So, yes, cold laser therapy, or I believe it's called a class 4 laser, is something that physical therapists can use. I am not familiar if there's strong evidence supporting its use specifically for low back pain. Having said that, Becky, some physical therapists will use it in a very multifaceted plan of care. So I wouldn't just get cold laser therapy treatment, a passive treatment in and of itself. And if you would see a physical therapist, they may use it, but it would be in addition to manual therapy, mobilization, a home exercise program, things like that. And I think part of the reason that we don't have good evidence necessarily with lasers and things like that is because physical therapists, as a general rule, do not use those modalities in isolation. Mm-hmm. So it's usually part of a multifaceted plan of care.
And the same is true for other disciplines, whether it's a chiropractor or some other health professional, they rarely use something like a laser in isolation. So when they do the research on it, it's always, well, we used laser, but we also did these three other things. So to be able to sort out how much of the laser contributed to the outcome is really unknown.
Gail in Wapaka has something for us. Hi, Gail.
Hello. Actually, I'm driving. After my knee replacement surgeries, I use a stationary bike at our fitness center, and it has different levels of, it goes into different levels of strength, and it seemed to help a lot with my knee replacement recovery, but I'm wondering, is this a good thing to help with my back? My back seems to get weak after standing, walking a distance. Is this a good exercise?
Absolutely. Is it a recumbent bike or an upright bike?
I think it's a recumbent bike.
So you're sitting back and leaning back and biking?
Biking is a great exercise for overall strength, mobility, etc. I think in terms of your back, it would be useful to add some other things that actually loaded your back or use the muscles in your back a bit more, because in a recumbent, your back is really fully supported. So even in an upright bike, you have to do a little bit more balancing and weight bearing on your hands, which is going to engage your core a little bit more. So I absolutely think the bike is a great idea, but I would also want to add some specific strengthening exercises for your core muscles in addition to the bike.
I think the bike will do a great job with her glutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gail, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim emailed, is there a connection between being sedentary and your mental health?
Oh, well, that's a really good question.
How much time do we have left?
Exactly. I would say that that's probably the case, but I have not examined that literature.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what comes first?
Yeah.
Right, right.
Does poor mental health cause you to become sedentary? Are you more sedentary? Or which comes first? I don't know that we can say cause and effect as much as perhaps an association.
Yeah.
Would probably what the literature demonstrates. But it's a great question. Yeah.
Well, and it's probably hard to study because we don't know what people are doing when they're sitting. You know, right. Are you doing crossword puzzles or are you just doing something passive, just watching Netflix? Right.
Emily in Madison has a question. Hi, Emily.
Hi, I had a trampoline park accident where I fractured my talus, both my sesamoid bones, and my first toe joint.
Ouch.
And I've had a few, and torn ligaments, and I've had a few surgeries to repair. My most recent was in March. But I'm having foot pain when I walk, and I'm still in PT. But I'm wondering if I need to see, like, a foot specialist, and it's kind of my timeline. This happened last June. If my timeline is having my most recent surgery in March is, like, still appropriate. I know that it's, like, unique. I had a surgery on the toe joint and then on my ankle.
Yeah. Actually, I'm seeing somebody in a very similar situation who had surgery recently, as did you, and I'm seeing them in the pool. So I would absolutely say that you should continue with your PT. The pool would be a great place for you to add some exercise without putting so much weight on your foot. So one of the issues with things in the foot, ankle, knee, and hip is that a lot of the exercise is weight bearing or you're sitting. But in the pool, you can do limited weight bearing in a standing position.
And as we talked about that earlier, that a talus fracture is a tough, tough fracture because it's so covered with articular cartilage and it's such an interestingly shaped bone. It does so much. And the congruency with your ankle joint is so tight that, I think you're on a very appropriate timeline. It's a pretty unusual injury, actually.
Yeah.
Emily, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And with that, we are out of time. Lori and Jill, thank you both so much, and we'll look forward to your visit next month.
Awesome. It'll be fun, as always.
As always.
Absolutely.
Lori and Jill, Lori Tynbrody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne is a mom professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the science of color, red, yellow, purple, all of them. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to the science of color. Different colors, I think, mean different things to people. Some say red makes you feel hungry or maybe angry. Yellow, you know, all those smiley faces are yellow. I think, they've supposedly yellow inspires happiness. Blue is soothing. And for the next half hour, we'll talk about the science of color, the meanings, the feelings, the behaviors they promote with our guest, Karen Schloss, as an associate professor of cognition in UW-Madison's Department of Psychology and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Her visual reasoning lab studies how people interpret meaning from visual features with a focus on color. So, what's your favorite color? Why is it? What does the color mean to you? How does it make you feel better, maybe? Or are there colors that you just don't like? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Karen Schloss, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your research looks at color semantics.
Yes. So I'm interested in the meaning people ascribe to color. So if I were to give you a map of, say, different amounts of snowfall and ask you where there's going to be more or less snowfall, how can we design a map that you know that without any legends or labels giving you the answer? Or if I give you a set of bins to throw away your trash and recyclables, is there a way that we can do that where you know from the color where, say, your trash and your compost should go and without any kinds of legends or labels? And that's the kind of work that my lab does.
Yeah. Well, I've got a yellow disposable garbage thing, and I've got a green one. And the green one is where I put the recyclables, and the yellow, or the tan, I guess I could call it. It's the city of Madison's.
Yes, so there will be some conventions within cities, but if we give people on a computer a bunch of different bins and ask them which bin is for paper, plastic, glass, metal, compost, and trash, so six different kinds of things,
yeah,
we can design colors so people know exactly where those objects should go without any legends or labels. And the reason we can do that is because people have associations between colors and concepts. So if I give you the concept paper and I ask you for a bunch of colors, how much do you associate this concept with all these different colors? And I do the same thing with plastic, trash, metal, and compost, and so on. We can think of associations as distributions over all of the colors that we can see. And the same thing goes with emotion. So you mentioned at the beginning the idea that maybe red is angry or yellow is happy. But the idea is it's not that there's just a one-to-one mapping between a color and emotion. So light colors generally are associated with happiness.
Okay.
Darker ones are associated with sadness. Turns out yellows tend to be light. And so that's why people generally associate yellow with happiness.
Well, here we are both wearing dark tops. But you have a big smile on your face.
Well, the good news is our associations between colors and emotions don't necessarily influence how colors make us feel. So I'll unpack that for you. So people generally associate deep reds with the emotion anger. But UW-Madison is covered in red. And if that color actually made us angry compared to, say, the blue at Michigan, we might have some issues. And so just because we associate colors with certain concepts doesn't mean those colors necessarily make us feel that way. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done to understand how colors actually make us feel. We know a lot more about the associations.
So why do you do that research?
I am generally motivated by making a world that's easier for people to understand and more enjoyable to experience. So if we understand how people interpret meaning from colors, we can use color and design to make the world easier to interpret.
Okay. So talk about the Schloss Visual Reasoning Lab at UW-Madison. What all goes on there?
Yes. So,
is it a brightly colored place?
we have a very vivid turquoise couch and chairs that are a greener turquoise with a cool orange pattern on them. So I would say yes, but in spare amounts. So in my lab, we have graduate students and undergraduate students, and we do research. And so we show people displays on computers or sometimes real-world objects, and we ask them to make judgments about them. And again, the goal is to understand how we can use color and design, and now we're starting to look at textures, not just colors, to understand how we can communicate better.
So textures. So give me an example of how color, probably color and texture together, I'm guessing.
So right now we're looking at textures and just grayscale, but we're also doing tactile textures. So we give people textures in boxes that they can't see and they touch them with their hands. So we want to understand if our findings that we've discovered with color extend outside of color and even outside of vision to touch. So imagine that you have low vision or blindness, and you want to interpret a weather map or some political trends and data, but you can't see the visualization. So how can we design them in a way that people can understand them through touch instead? So we're trying to understand where our knowledge of vision can generalize or extend to touch, and where maybe we need to develop new kinds of knowledge when we're studying touch.
Wondering, well, when you talked about touch, I was thinking about maps that are raised maps. But then I got thinking about maps that you might just look at on a screen, or the one that, with the governor's photo on it, the printed ones. And they're all of I'm trying to think. They're typical colors, I guess, but is there some science behind that with a map, you think?
Yes. So with a map, especially if you're using color to represent amounts of things, people have something called a dark is more bias, where they tend to think that darker colors mean more. So if I show you a map where I represent larger numbers, so greater population with darker colors, it'll be easier for people to interpret. But if the map represents something that is strongly associated with a light color, so say sunshine, then people will infer, say, a really vivid yellow will represent more than a dark gray. And so what this suggests is that we need to think about these associations people have between individual colors and concepts, and also these kinds of relations like dark is more. So one of the things my lab is doing is we're trying to understand all the different kinds of factors that contribute to how people will interpret colors, and then create an online tool that makes it really easy for people to design visualizations that will be easy for people to interpret. So several years ago, we made a tool that's available on our website called ColorGoracle, colorgoracle.com, I believe, but you can find it on our lab website. And for that, you can tell it how many colors you want, and it will give you a set of colors that are hopefully aesthetically preferable, meaning you'd like to look at them, and you can tell the colors apart visually. And so there can be trade-offs between preference and being able to see the difference between colors. I can unpack that if you're interested. But the main thing is that as someone without any design experience, you can go into the tool and say, I want three colors, and I want them to be in the reddish family, go, and it will generate colors for you that are useful in design. But what the tool does not yet do is it doesn't let you to say, I want to represent bananas, blueberries, and strawberries. You can't give it semantics or actual concepts yet to tell it what colors you want. And so that's, we're doing the science now to be able to make the tool even better. So it doesn't only help you make pretty designs that you can see the difference between the colors, but also you can tell what the colors mean.
But if I saw it, it also doesn't, if you're doing it for, like, let's say a marketing or to get somebody to, you know, pay attention to it, if it was three reds, that might look good to you, but is that going to be something that's going to capture other people's attention?
So marketing is an interesting question, because then you've got brand colors and you have capturing attention. So capturing attention you can get by having the colors be different from each other and can be very different from the background that they're on. But the brand coloring within this tool, you can actually say, my brand is blues and greens. And so you can tell it to design around those particular colors as well. So you can say, I don't want any reds at all, because that's my competitor's brand. And so, yeah, we can build those kinds of constraints.
All right. Luzine emailed to ask, how does pattern affect the perception or emotions associated with color? That's interesting.
That's an excellent question. And in the siloed world that my lab lives in, we're studying color as color just swatches and patterns in grayscale. So my work yet hasn't brought the two together, which I realize might sound silly, but that's the way we've been approaching it so far. But the idea is that the associations that you have with colors and with patterns are influenced by your lifetime of experiences. So if you see a color in a glossy material versus in a kind of more matte material, that might evoke different kinds of objects you've experienced in your lifetime. I'm trying to think of, I'm going to give a kind of potentially gross example. So for shades of brown, so if you have shades of brown that look like they're a chocolatey texture versus a biological waste texture, then the associations you have with those colors and textures combined will be different. Because of the combination of the spatial pattern in it as well as the color.
Christina in Glenwood City has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. We are going to paint the entire interior of our home, and I would like it to be a comfortable, inviting color. I don't have one in mind right now, and I'm wondering if there's a website or if what suggestions you have to help with our decision.
It's a
great question. Part of that is just general associations with calmness. So generally, bluer, greener colors and lighter and less vivid colors are going to be more calm. But part of that is about your own personal preferences. So if I tell you that blues and greens are generally calm to people on average, but you have really negative associations with those colors. For example, one of my friends, I wanted to paint our lab back when I was a student. I wanted to paint it this beautiful teal color. And I was like, science suggests this is a really calm, great color. And he was like, there is no way I will let you put that color on the wall because it's the color that the doctor's office was when I was a kid. And when I see that color, it is the opposite of calm. I had to go there a lot. It was really stressful. So absolutely not. And so as you're thinking about what color to how to color your environment, part of it you can look at the science of people on average, but part of it is looking at yourself and what do you like to look at when you look at the samples, what makes you feel good or what makes you feel calm, and think about how you want to feel in the space.
Christina, there you go. Thanks so much for calling in. Appreciate it. You can join in too. The number to call 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Miller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News, talking about the science behind color with our guest today, Karen Schloss, Associate Professor of Cognition at UW-Madison's Department of Psychology and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. She leads the Schloss Visual Reasoning Lab, SVRL. There we go. You can join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. In football, famously, the University of Iowa has painted, many years ago they started this, they painted the visiting team colors where they, you know, their locker room pink. Because they thought that it would make them calm and not aggressive. And I think even a prison's done it too.
So there was some older work that suggested that might be true, but has since been debunked with a lot more careful science. So there was a study a long time ago that looked at the painting prisons pink and suggested it might be a soothing, calming color, but turns out there were a lot of problems with the study. And so when people later on did much more careful studies, they found no evidence that pink is any more calming or better than, say, white walls.
Well, I thought it was kind of cool. I remember some of the coaches kind of complaining about it and not liking to have that kind of color there. Are there colors that are known to, are there colors that evoke particular emotions?
So generally, there's a lot more work on the associations people have with emotions rather than felt emotions. But there is some evidence that that more brighter, more vivid colors can be more arousing, so more activating to the system. And potentially redder colors also being a bit more arousing or activating than, say, bluer colors.
And do a majority of people perceive color pretty much the same?
That is a deep philosophical question. There is, so let's say that you and I both have what we call typical color vision. There is absolutely no way for me to know what you're experiencing. So as we look at the same colored patch, there's no way for me to know what your experience is like to be able to say that we are experiencing the same thing. What we can do is see if you and I can see the differences between colors. So I can say, I see a difference between these two colors, and you say, no, I don't see the difference between those two colors. And so if that happens, then we know we have different kinds of color vision experiences in that way. But there's the old question of, is your red the same as my red? From an experience perspective,
yeah.
No way to know, which is kind of terrifying and also exciting to think that your sensory experiences in that way are kind of private and special just to you.
At the same time, now we can look at our microphones, and there's both a red lights on those microphones, and they tell us that the microphones are live. And even if I visualize the red differently from you, I'd still know that I should be careful how I speak when that red light's on.
That is correct, because you have a mapping between the word red and that experience. So when we both have the experience we have when we see that red color, we call it red. And so in that case, we can talk about color in a way that we have common ground or common knowledge. Whether we're seeing that the red is the same is kind of neither here nor there when we're talking about using color for communication. So knowing that the microphone on and people can hear us right now.
Billy in Wataka, Minnesota. We'll go to you. Hi, Billy.
Hi. I was wondering if you've been paying attention to the interaction of color, like Joseph Albers had written a major work on quite a while ago.
Absolutely.
And how a color looks differently depending on the background color.
Yes, and Albers is one of my most favoriteest painters. I love going to the MoMA in San Francisco and just standing in front of his work and looking how he was exploring color through his paintings. Yes, absolutely. So colors will look different depending on the background. And so as we're thinking about color in design, and especially in data visualization, if you think this color looks, let's say, this shade of red on a white background, and then you put it on a different background and it looks totally different, then that can completely change the meaning that color is communicating. Also, Albers did beautiful work on color combinations, so which colors are harmonious or look good together. And his work countered some of the previous claims that complementary colors are harmonious or preferable. So if I ask you, if I give you two colors, let's say orange and a blue, and I say, how harmonious are these? How well do the colors go together? Versus I give you, instead of an orange and a blue, I give you like a tealish blue, a bluish green, and a blue. Generally, people will say the more similar colors look more harmonious. And my dissertation work actually was trying to understand, so test some of the ideas that were in Albers' writings, as well as writings from other color theorists. And we find that our data actually aligns most with Albers as opposed to some of the other theorists.
So colors that are sort of closer together are going to be more pleasing to people.
Exactly. So colors that are more similar in hue, so like red, yellow, green, blue, closer together that way, will be more harmonious and also more preferable. They'll like them more. But they like colors with lightness contrast, so like a light blue with a darker blue. So they're different in how light versus dark they are, but they're both blues.
Hmm. Well, speaking of blues, I was with my daughter at Disney World. And we were in this rest area, and there was a color blue there that I liked a lot. So I took a picture of it because I was painting my house back here in Madison. And I took that home and I showed it to the painter, and he said, "Oh yeah, I can do that." And he painted it this blue, which it was a color that you saw a lot in Florida, but not as much in Madison. So my house stands out a little bit, but I live on the east side of Madison where colors and people are, well, the people there seem to like it a lot.
That's fantastic. And that raises the interesting question of why did you like that color in the first place? And so a lot of my work has been on understanding why people like some colors more than others and why people even have color preferences in the first place. And so the idea is that when you were looking at that particular shade of blue that you liked so much, it brought to mind all of the kinds of things that you associate with that shade of blue. So if I were to ask you what comes to mind when you think about that blue, what comes to mind for you right now?
Well, what comes to mind right at this instant was it's the same color of a shirt that I had when I was a young guy, and I loved that shirt.
There you go. And it's also the color of, say, sky when it's beautiful to play outside,
yes,
and clear water and all kinds of positive things. And on average, blues are generally associated with really positive things, and it's really hard to think of negative things that are blue, which is why, on average, blue is the most preferred color in many cultures across the world. Not in all, but in many. And so the idea is that your preference for that color is determined by how much you like all the things that are associated with that color, and that's what shapes your color preferences generally. And so that's why also different people would have different color preferences. So I might have experiences, even with that beautiful blue color, maybe it was the doctor's office I didn't want to go to or some other reason. And so my preference for that same color would be influenced by how much I like all the things associated with that color. And so what that means is that we can explain why different people have different color preferences, but why our color preferences can change over time. So if, let's say, you love that color, but then you go back to Disney World and you have a really terrible vacation for whatever reason, and you see that color all around, then that would put a little notch in how much you like that color, and you might want to change your walls when you get home.
Well, it's the outside of the house, and believe me, at the cost of a 3-story house to paint it, I will not be changing.
Let's keep all positive experiences with that blue for you, then.
Bill in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, how do people know how animals see colors? You know, we hear research about certain animals seeing colors differently or not at all. Do you know how we figure that out?
Yes, so we can understand animals' ability to tell the difference between colors by giving them kinds of tasks where they're rewarded if they can say these two. Say I'm anthropomorphizing animals now. If it's a pigeon and they can peck on which swatch has two different colors versus which swatch is the same. So we can do these kinds of behavioral measures. Similarly with dogs, if a dog can't tell the difference, let's say you train up a dog to walk towards the food's going to be in the yellow bowl, and then you give them food in, say, a yellow bowl and then another color that they can't tell the difference between that and the yellow, then they'll go to both bowls equally. But if they can consistently go to the bowl that they've learned is the bowl that has their food, then you can tell that they can see the difference between those colors. So through these kinds of tests, we can tell which colors animals can tell apart and which ones they can't.
Interesting. Thank you for that question. Vern and Boyd called to say that three or more primary colors viewed on a computer are difficult to focus on simultaneously.
So light, as it bends through the eye, longer wavelength light will bend as it goes through the lens different amounts than shorter wavelength light. So longer wavelength light meaning reds and shorter wavelength light meaning blues. And so if you have light that is very, very long wavelength and very short wavelength, where it focuses on the eye will be different. And it's hard to get both into focus at the same time. And so that can lead sometimes to one color looking closer to you and the other one further away. And if they are right up against each other, it can kind of look like they're almost vibrating and it's visually uncomfortable.
And different cultures ascribe, you know, as we talk about colors, ascribe different meanings to color, do they not?
They do, yes. And so these could be cultural conventions or symbolism. They can also be differences in the kind of experiences they have with objects in their world. And so these cultural differences should and do influence cultural difference in things like color preferences and interpretations of color meaning, because both of those are influenced by the kinds of associations that people have.
Ginger email, what do or should animators consider when making a character a particular color? Any good stories there?
I love that question. I would say, what kind of ideas do you want that character to evoke? So if you want the character to evoke ideas of fun and playful, you would make really vibrant, vivid colors. If you want the character to evoke sadness or seriousness, it would be darker grayish sort of colors. So I would look at the findings on the emotional associations people have with colors, and that can be a way to approach coloring character design.
Well, here we've only scratched the surface of color, Karen. And we'll come. I'd love to have you back sometime. We can talk again. I'd like to know more about your research, and let's do that.
Absolutely. I would love to.
Karen Schloss, our guest, Associate Professor of Cognition at the UW-Madison's Department of Psychology and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. Her visual reasoning lab studies how people interpret meaning from various visual features with a focus on color. Great to have her with us, and we will have her back, and I hope you'll be back as well. Great to have you with us today. Just a reminder, we've got a team here. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, and our executive producer is the vacationing Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.